Welcome to Mortification of Spin, a casual conversation about things that count, with Carl Truman and Todd Pruitt, a podcast of the Alliance of Confessing Evangelicals. Let's join this week's conversation.
Welcome to Mortification of Spin. My name's Carl Truman. I'm Professor of Biblical and Religious Studies at the wonderful Grove City College in beautiful Western Pennsylvania. Here, as always, with my good friend and co-host, the Reverend Todd Pruitt, pastor of a PCA congregation, Covenant Presbyterian Church, in Harrisonburg, Virginia, in the equally beautiful Shenandoah Valley. Good to be with you, Todd.
Good to be with you, Carl. It's good to see you as always, albeit through a screen. Which absence makes the heart grow fonder, I guess.
So I'm told. It's good to see you in something which has sleeves, today.
It's really cold out here. It's really cold out here today. And I'm happy to oblige. I know that you are not particularly thrilled to see my bare arms, so I went with the hoodie today. So now I have my John Fetterman look. You're a senator, by the way, correct?
I'm afraid he is. Yes. although having said that, he's actually made one or two good decisions recently.
Isn't that so amazing? People
credit
think
where credit's due. Where credit's due. He's not proving to be quite the creature of the radical left that at one point he promised to be.
Yeah, they're starting to hate on him now. So that's always encouraging.
And he doesn't care, which I always admire in a man.
A man who will walk around looking like he does, or looking like I do.
Yeah, I was going to say, a man who walks around looking like Todd Pruitt.
He's got to be secure. Yeah,
secure in his manhood, yes.
Speaking of security, who's our guest today?
Well, we have, talking about, somebody totally secure in their manhood, repeat guest, the Reverend Mark Jones, a senior minister of faith, Vancouver Presbyterian Church, PCA, author and editor of many books. In fact, I think most recently we had Mark on because of the work he'd done relative to the beautiful new edition of Stephen Charnock on the existence and attributes of God. Yep. Mark, great to have you with us.
Thank you so much for having me yet again. I'm hoping this will be the last time, because every time I write a book, it takes 10 years off my life. So I'd like to make this the last one.
I should mention the book, actually. we're interviewing Mark about his new book, which is The Pilgrim's Regress, Guarding Against Backsliding and Apostasy in the Christian Life, published by our friends at PNR. Todd, you were going to say something
before. Well, I was just going to say, Mark was just explaining how writing a book takes about 10 years off of his life. And so, but we could have him on for another reason. I mean, Mark, is there anything else interesting that you do other than write books?
Yes, I. Soccer coach, and now, that helps me to de-stress. But the problem is I'm so competitive, it actually has the opposite effect. So I go to the ministry now for my relaxation from soccer.
Oh well, I mean, there's some psychology going on there that we could perhaps maybe we could have a counselor on with Mark the next time, and we could work through some of that stuff.
That's true. And I assume, Todd, that actually not writing books and not engaging in sport is the secret of your eternal youthfulness.
It's why I look so good at this age.
Yeah. I'm envious and in awe, brother. Envious and in awe.
Avoid effort at just about everything, and you'll look as good as I do. So
So on the book, Mark.
You guys are missing more hair, though.
We are well aware of that.
It's the sheer size of our brains that has pushed the hair out, and it's just fallen out.
That's what it is. Really? Well, we ought to talk about the book.
Yeah, yes. I was going to ask you, Mark, I want to avoid I'm told that John Stone Street thinks the why did you write this book question is the question that should never be asked in a podcast. So I can understand why. But I do want to ask you, why this book now? Because apostasy has been around for a long time. An awful lot of theologians have written on apostasy over the years. Why this book now? What do you think it brings to the table that is particularly relevant at this particular moment in our time?
Sure. There's, at least in my mind, as more I research, the more I realized, you know, pastors, let's say a couple hundred years ago, and even maybe 100 or 200 years ago, there was a lot of literature written on the nature of backsliding, apostasy, etc. And if you look at recent literature, there hasn't been a whole lot that's really tackled the subject or even wanted to admit the realities of this in the Reformed tradition. You know, we've had a very strong emphasis on justification and salvation by grace and all those things. And you get a lot of tweets that are always comforting God's people, which is fine. But I mean, the reality is, if you read the scriptures, there's a lot of warnings. There's a lot of troubling things that have happened in the Old and New Testament with regards to God's people. And I thought, after COVID and all that it did to the church, there's a very serious need to confront what is an obvious pastoral issue for many pastors, and that is a lot of people have just fallen away or become extremely lazy in their Christian living.
Mm-hmm. Mark, when I was growing up, I grew up in conservative, broad evangelicalism, Southern Baptist megachurch life. Now, what I'm thankful for is that the church I was raised in, I really did hear the gospel. I heard justification by faith preached. Those were very clear, very thankful for that. I would also hear warnings about backsliding. And so if you were raised in a Southern Baptist church, you've probably heard some sermons on backsliding. Okay, so far, so good. The problem, and I really didn't realize this until I embraced the Reformed faith. The problem is that in those messages about backsliding, you would simultaneously be guaranteed that, now, once saved, always saved, so you're going to heaven. And right then the backslider goes, good, then I'm fine. Mm. And I understand, but this is where the Reformed doctrines of things like perseverance of the saints, which is different from quote, once saved, always saved. But the specificity of perseverance of the saints, the distinction between the visible and invisible church and genuine warnings about actually having a category for apostasy, first of all, really helped make sense of the scriptures to me. But it helped me also see what was missing in the warnings I heard growing up about backsliding, which ultimately didn't have any teeth to them. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if you would help some of our folks kind of understand in these historic Reformed biblical categories we have, what apostasy is and why the Bible warns against it. Because I actually have to answer this question a lot as a pastor from people who are coming from non-Reformed backgrounds to our church. I'll say something like apostasy, and that's a brand new thing for them.
Yeah.
What are we talking about?
Well, you know, this is something that I think if you go to the confessional documents like Canons of Dort, for example, one of the real truly international confessional documents for the Reformed faith, if you look at that, you would say that in the section on perseverance, I think it's 514, but I'm not sure. They talk about how the gospel has several purposes in how the saints persevere. And one of the ways in which God preserves us and how we persevere is through the threatenings of the gospel, not just its promises. And so there's sort of a dual focus. The first would be that there are warnings in scripture. They are made to Christians. They are not made to this sort of group of people who sit in a corner of the church that don't have the seal of election on them. So Christians are given warnings all throughout the scriptures, but even in the New Testament. And then the reality of apostasy is that we don't have access, in terms of the Reformed covenant theology we believe in, to the decree of who is definitely elect and who isn't. So someone may be baptized, a member in good standing, and they sin in certain ways and fall away from the church. And we say they have apostatized, that they really have fallen away. And what's remarkable to me is that our Reformed forefathers who wrote the Confessions and were robust in their Reformed theology will actually talk about losing benefits, losing blessings that they really did possess. And Thomas Gudrun, a chapter on this, where Thomas Gudrun talks about they even did possess the Holy Spirit in a certain sense. Now, not in quite the same way that the true elect will, but still they lost something. And so it's a real apostasy. It's not just a sort of two camps. There's wicked people in the church and they apostatize. No, these wicked people even show signs of grace at times to us outwardly.
And this is at the heart of the warnings in the, you know, infamous warning passages in Hebrews. These are people who have, quote, tasted of the heavenly gift. So we're not talking about someone who completely lacks an understanding of the gospel and has not in some way received blessings from being attached to the church and the influence of the gospel in their life. Something that is real to a certain extent has gone on. They might even be convinced of it themselves. This isn't the person, as you said, hiding, who knows they're not converted, but they're just sitting in the back of the church with their arms folded. Yeah. These are people who may feel genuinely touched at times by the gospel, and yet scriptures have warnings for them. And that's hard for a lot of folks to navigate.
Yeah, I think as pastors, we have friends, or maybe former friends, who we spent, you know, had a lot of great fellowship with. Like we sang hymns together,
right,
and psalms, of course, and, you know, prayed together and talked about things of the Lord. And then they leave their family, commit adultery, they, you know, do something crazy, and they never return to the church. Now, obviously, I don't know the final end with some people. But the point is, they appear to be apostates, and yet what you experienced with them felt like real, genuine Christian fellowship.
Right.
How do you, as a pastor, develop a strategy for this, Mark? I'm thinking, I remember hearing many, many years ago a reference to a preacher, a famous preacher, long, long since gone to be with the Lord. And this person made the comment to me that I could always tell when this person had been preaching in the area, because my people would go and hear him and they'd come back with critical problems, with lack of assurance. And it does seem to me the New Testament, yes, it contains lots of stern warnings. On the other hand, it also contains vibrant statements of confidence. How do you, as a pastor, build a preaching strategy or a pastoral strategy that does justice to the warnings, but which yet is gentle with, you know, not everybody struggling with doubts is apostatizing. Not everyone struggling with doubts is doing so because they've fallen into immorality, for example.
Yeah.
I've got a good friend in the UK who's, you know, he lost his wife recently, and I'm sure he has dark moments. His faith seems strong, but I'm sure there are moments when the darkness closes in on him. How do you, as a pastor, think through a strategy that's going to, disturb the complacent, but reassure those who are simply struggling for very legitimate reasons because of the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, we might say?
That's a great, great question and topic. And for me, and I'm not saying I've sorted this out definitively, but as a pastor, I first take the stress off of myself by allowing corporate worship to do its job and God to do his job. And when you're praying, you know, prayers of confession, when you're singing robust hymns, when you're taking the Lord's Supper, like the Reformed faith is an ecosystem of interrelated parts that are all helping each other out. And so my role then as a pastor would be, and I'm not saying you have to preach through books all the time, but generally that's been my approach. As I go through the book of John, for example, and there's a heavy emphasis on the book of John, on Christians who are kind of on the fence, maybe, and people who are like, is Christ really worth following? And you know, John takes care of a lot of types of issues. And then you go to maybe a book of Daniel, or which is what I'm doing, but I allow the books to kind of bring out the emphases that need to be brought out. And so I release the stress for myself. Now, you can get a pastor who finds a nice comforting verse and he's still going to find a way to scare people because it's just for some reason in his DNA. But I do think if we're faithful to the scriptures and sort of the application does come from the text, we should be safe from, you know, going too far into one direction. So that's been my approach, is to allow the scriptures to take the stress off of my ministry and then not make the sermon the be all and end all of someone's assurance experience on a Sunday, but allowing everything in the worship service to do that. And, you know, when we stir one another up to love and good works at the worship service, that's right before in Hebrews 10:25, right before the warning. So, but for people who are careless and reckless with their faith, there needs to be something where we say, hey, you can't live like this, and you can use promises, but you also have scriptural ground to use warnings.
Yeah. I've found something really similar. I resonate very much with what you talk about, with what you mentioned about the church's corporate worship, and our liturgy goes a long way in communicating these things. One of the things I explained to our church some years ago was the reason why we have a corporate confession of sin and an assurance of pardon every week is that Christians need to confess their sin. It's there to work on the conscience of unrepentant Christians, but also serves as a witness to those unbelievers that are there to talk to them about their sin, to recognize that, you know, this past Sunday, I read the first table of the law, and then we went into a time of confession and explained how, you know, this God is going to use this in our hearts to highlight sin, to bring you to repentance. And then you're going to be ready to hear the assurance of pardon, which is a real word of real forgiveness from the Lord. But there's a genius in the historic Christian liturgy that is instructive along those lines. If we'll just use it right.
Yeah.
And preaching too. I mean, you mentioned preaching. Let the Lord set your agenda for that. And that's part of the beauty of primarily preaching through books of the Bible, is eventually you come across those passages that are just deep in their comfort for God's people. And then also those that confront us. And I've been preaching through the Gospel of John, and then I've taken a break just to preach through Romans 8 because I want to preach through Romans 8 before I die, and I don't know when I'm going to die. So I thought, well, let's do that. And, you know, we're in Romans 8. So you have these marvelous promises, but you also have this call to stop walking in the flesh, that's not who you are anymore. And the conclusion is, if you continue to walk in the flesh, it's because you're in the flesh and not in the spirit. And so right in the midst of Romans chapter 8, some of the greatest promises of assurance in the Bible, right plopped in the middle of it is the warning that if you're walking in the flesh, it's likely because you're of the flesh. Yeah. So the scripture gives us the means to do that.
I had a member this week, he phoned me, and he was having some mental health struggles, and it's a long story, but, you know, he was swearing at me on the phone and stuff, and it was fine in a sense. Like, I was like, okay, I got to deal with this guy. And it was one of the more rewarding pastoral conversations I've had over 50 minutes, even though he was swearing at me. And, you know, he was asking, he's like, you need to kick our backsides. He didn't quite use that language, but I'll leave that to the imagination. And, you know, I've had people who, and I know he's got some struggles, but I've had people who, I think genuine Christians do see the need that they need to be confronted from, you know, Lloyd-Jones called the pulpit a place of holy confrontation. Mm. And I do think people, while they don't want to have a fight every week with the pastor, you know, in terms of, I do think people are yearning for a bit of confrontation at times with their souls, and not kind of getting bored every weekend with the same sort of sappy message that is passing in many Reformed churches. It's antinomian, it's weak, and I think people see through it, actually. So I think for me, having those times where you do, you know, have a strong word, not every week, maybe not even every month, but you do need those words, and I think people genuinely appreciate it.
That's absolutely been my experience as a pastor, is when correction is offered and it's clearly biblical and not just my hobby horse, it's clearly yeah. from the scriptures, Christians are grateful for that because mm-hmm. Christians want to grow. Mm-hmm. You know, they want to sin less. And yeah. so when you're faithful to bring them the word on that, Christians are typically really thankful for that. Yeah. Carl, you'll remember this also. Mark, the very first time we ever had you on this program was after your book, Antinomianism. And so this yeah. is going back a ways. And and we had some of these conversations, and it was kind of at the height, that book came at the height of kind of the liberation theology and Tullian Chivijan and which was just kind of old-fashioned antinomianism. And one of the things that was happening in a lot of PCA pulpits was under the guise of, quote, gospel-centered, people yeah. were hearing promises and were for that, absolutely, but they were never hearing God's law. The sharp edge of the law was never being brought close to their hearts. And we hurt God's people that way. Yeah.
Yeah. I think this is just this book's a part two to the antinomianism, and it hasn't fully gone away. So I've tried to kind of say, here's another aspect that we need to deal mm-hmm. with in light of, you know, those trends that were solved somewhat, but not right. entirely.
Well, I was excited when I saw the book because, as I mentioned earlier, I heard, like every other Southern Baptist, I heard a lot about backsliding when I was a kid growing up, but there was never actually a warning connected to it because there wasn't a category for apostasy,
yeah,
which the scriptures give us.
Yeah.
And we have to know how to marshal those biblical warnings for the good of God's people's souls. And I think oftentimes because of the contemporary gospel-centered movement, and mm-hmm. if I'm allowed to define that phrase, then I'm all for it. But because of that, I'm afraid we have a lot of Presbyterian churches where the people have never been duly warned about backsliding.
Yeah, and I think one other thing is the 5 points became a sort of, this is Calvinism, and it became right. divorced from covenant theology, right? Right.
What about further reading, Mark, as we're sort of drawing towards the close here? Other books, great historic books that our listeners should check out in addition to yours. I always found one of the things I loved about J.I. Packer was I'd read J.I. Packer and then I'd go off and read half a dozen books that he'd recommend in his sort of, you know, his arguments. What would you say should be the next, you know, any pastor reading this book should also read X, Y, and Z? What would they be?
Yeah, so I would say that for me, the best book I read on it was Octavius Winslow. He was the 19th century pastor, who's contemporary of Spurgeon and Ryle, and doesn't get quite the same, you know, fame as them. And you know, he wrote Personal Declension and Revival of Religion in the Soul. And that one was a book that I thought, wow, you know, this is beautifully written. It's penetrating. It's kind of the best of that Victorian age theology. So I was really impressed with that. I know most people have heard about John Owen, you know, apostasy and all that, but I would probably just say, you know, I wouldn't read Owen on apostasy. It's scholastic. It's you know, generally correct but I would go with Winslow. You know, I just think that one was good. I mean, there's lots in the footnotes. They PNR decided to go with footnotes. I'm probably one of the only EndNotes fans in the world.
I hate EndNotes.
I hate EndNotes. Yeah.
you know, I'm really bad with details. So when there's footnotes, it shows all of the mistakes I make. So that's why I like EndNotes, because it hides my poor footnoting. So it's more of a selfish reason. But there's, you know, Andrew Fuller for the Michael Haken acolytes. Andrew Fuller has the backslider. You know, but then you find these really cool sections in various works, like J.C. Ryle's book on holiness is kind of on backsliding in a sense. And you read Remember Lot's Wife before you go to bed and you won't sleep. So, you know, there's some good stuff out there.
And plus, Octavius Winslow and J.C. Ryle are eminently more readable than John Owen.
Yes. And Spurgeon, actually. I still find Spurgeon tough going, to be perfectly honest. He's, you know, Ryle's just so simple.
He is.
So yeah, those would be, I'd really say read the Winslow book and you'll be really rewarded.
That's good. That's good to hear. Well, our guest has been Mark Jones, and once again, he has work that we highly commend. Mark always blesses us with something that's worth reading, and this yet again is another one. As I said earlier, as soon as I saw the subtitle, I was thankful for it and knew that it would be useful. Mark writes in a pastoral, very accessible way. And I would encourage you to get this book. It's called The Pilgrim's Regress, Guarding Against Backsliding and Apostasy in the Christian Life. Read it as an individual. Read it as a small group together. Don't think that you're going to feel miserable after reading every chapter. You won't, but you'll be challenged. And I encourage you to get it. In fact, you can go to our website, mortificationofspin.org, and you can register to win a copy of The Pilgrim's Regress. And we would encourage you to do that. And we would also encourage you, the Alliance of Confessing Evangelicals has an event coming up. It's an annual event that's been going on for many years, the Philadelphia Conference on Reformed Theology. It is taking place in two different locations on two different dates. In March, it'll take place at University Reformed Church in East Lansing, Michigan, and then in April at Proclamation Presbyterian Church in Bryn Mawr, Pennsylvania, in the Philadelphia metropolitan area. The topic is living in an anti-Christian world, and we think that you'll find it to be quite good speakers. Peter Jones, Aaron Wren, Richard Phillips. I'm quite sure the content will be challenging and helpful for you. So if you'll go to the Alliance website or check out a link on the Mortification of Spin website, you can see if either one of those opportunities will work for you. Well, thanks for joining us, and we look forward to being with you next time on Mortification of Spin.
Thanks for listening to Mortification of Spin, a podcast of the Alliance of Confessing Evangelicals. For more on topics like this, visit mortificationofspin.org, where you can find other articles by Carl and Todd, browse the archive of past episodes, and make a donation. We'll talk to you next time on Mortification of Spin.